The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. David Gustina is the producer of The Capital Connection. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.
It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm Alan Shartok. Joining us this week is one of my favorite people in the world. I really mean that. New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. Welcome back, Tom. Always great to have you here. You're a straight talker, and I like that.
Thank you, Alan, and congratulations on the fund drive going so well.
We did a good job here, and stations all over New York are having their fund drives, and we wish them all well. Okay, so the first question always you ask the comptroller is, how is the state doing financially? Are we doing good? Are we doing bad?
We're doing better. You know, Alan, remember, we began the year with that significant drop-off in revenue of, you know, $2.3 billion below projections and expectations. I think the governor correctly pointed out that the impact of the federal tax changes and SALT deduction being limited and so on had a lot to do with that. And the real concern is, would that be a recurring theme throughout the year? Well, when we've looked at our most recent cash report for April and very preliminary numbers for May, actually we've seen the trend has gone the other way. We're actually coming in now higher than projected, higher than last year. So I think what it means is that taxpayer behavior has definitely changed. We don't know quite what the new normal is yet. I think we still have to be careful as we go through the rest of the fiscal year, monitor spending and revenue. But certainly, from where we were in January, much improved with where we're sitting at this point in June. That gives me a good sense that the budget will hold together. But I still think it's getting used to what the new normal will be based on the federal tax changes and the impact that has on taxpayer behavior in New York.
So I have a political science-y kind of question for you. It's only in one word. Why? In other words, what's the psychology of the change that people who weren't putting in are putting in big time right now? Is it just the calendar?
I think it's a timing issue, you know, and that's always one of the complications of how we do budgeting in New York. You know, we're the only state really that has an April 1st beginning of the fiscal year. And one of the challenges there is that, you know, the significant tax payments are obviously done by April 15th. So, you know, we're somewhat making assumptions, but, you know, to get the budget done by April 1st. And because you had, you know, a lot of folks with the looming changes on the federal level, they pushed up some of their financial activity into 2017. It had an impact on 2018. Weren't sure what that meant for 2019. We're just starting to see the impact. You know, the other piece I think that's still a question mark is, are people going to leave a high-tech state like New York because of those changes? Mm. There's been some recent research looking at California, New York, other states suggest that's not been happening. Mm. But I still think it's too soon to know for sure. And you lose even a handful of people in that billionaire category. It has a huge impact in terms of personal income tax revenue, particularly for the state. So a lot of it we still have to wait and see. As I said, the good news is we're in a much better position today than we were 6 months ago. Let's hope that trend continues.
Now, you and the governor had a little bit of tiff. No. Let me change that. The governor had a little bit of a tiff. He decided to take some of your auditing powers, pre-auditing powers, away from you. A lot of people got very angry about that, and I was one of them, and said so again and again. And he did what he had to do, which was to give in finally, because it was unjustified. It was unjustified, and I can only say that he gave it up. But it was supposed to all be resolved by now. But I understand my people are telling me that it hasn't been resolved, that they haven't done, the governor and the legislature haven't done what they should, giving you back those functions. Now, that's disgraceful, and I want to know about it.
Yeah. Well, your people are on top of things. look, you know, our job is accountability and oversight and making sure taxpayer dollars are protected and we get best value. And I do think it was a mistake going back over a couple of budget cycles where our what's called the pre-audit authority or contract review was diluted and some of it was taken away. SUNY and CUNY construction contracts, centralized contracts, big multi-billion dollar contracts now done through the Office of General Services. And I do think part of, you know, creating that climate with less accountability is what contributed to what we saw with some of the scandals that we're all familiar with and some of the folks that, you know, are now ending up in jail.
Joe Pococo and some of the other guys, they're going to jail now.
Yeah.
And we think, and, I think, always have thought, that that would not have happened or might not have happened had you been, so they took away your, have you ever thought that maybe they took it away specifically so that you couldn't hold people accountable?
No, I mean, when this is done, it's done under the notion of being efficient. And it's done, you know, frankly, with a false narrative that we take, you know, an inordinate amount of time to do our review. We do contract review on average in significantly less than 2 weeks. I use 2 weeks as a very safe number. If it's a complex contract, it might take a little longer, but we turn around contracts really fast. So I think this notion of doing it for efficiency, you know, is frankly
that's BS. We all knew it was BS, but
I don't think it was done deliberately. But I don't think it was done deliberately so people could get away with stuff. But the problem, it creates a climate, right?
Right.
Where there is an independent review, right? So we can't say for sure that some of that stuff might still have happened. People always try to get away with something, right? But if there is an additional set of eyes looking at something, it creates a climate that, you know what, maybe I better think twice before I try to get away with something. But to your earlier point, yes, the governor and I came to an agreement on how to restore our role in an effective way. And I appreciate it. The governor reached out to me, and I welcome that opportunity. You know, the problem was, in the context of the budget negotiation, there were some competing versions on the wording of how to implement that.
There always is. You know, it's a bunch of baloney.
Well, but you know what part of it
we
is?
We can't pass this bill because the Senate said one thing and the Assembly said another thing. We all know it's a game.
But you know what part of the problem is?
No.
With even the beginning of when this became an issue. We were putting too much into the budget process of issues that really should stand on their own and be dealt with separately. So then you get into the crush. Everything's got to get done. There's not an agreement. You know, so yes, we conceptually have agreement for the restoration of that authority. And obviously our staffs have been talking about how that will be implemented. But you're right. We don't have the statutory wording. And that would be the best way to have everybody understanding we have a common playing field on this. So, you know.
I'll believe it I'll believe it when I see it. I'm telling you that right now. I'm not a happy guy about this. Look, there is a report that sex offenders are getting little blue pills on state taxpayers' dime. Is that right?
Well, we did an audit. Remember, this was an issue a number of years ago that this office identified as well. And we did find an instance of 47 individuals identified as sex offenders were able to get erectile function drugs and treatments. And that really is counter to what the rules are for the program. So
what are the rules? Whoa. What are the rules? Are the rules that you're not supposed to take
sex offenders are not supposed to get, they're not supposed to get those drugs, I think, for obvious reasons, as anybody could appreciate. So obviously there are still gaps, as we often find, in the Medicaid program and how claims are processed. In this case, you see a transition over to managed care organizations, and that's where I think there's been, you know, some of the breakdown. So Department of Health needs to make sure that, especially as we continue that transition to Medicaid through managed care, that managed care organizations understand what the rules are. I mean, the good news is when we pointed this out in the course of the audit, the Department of Health corrected those situations, but, you know, I think we're always disappointed when some of their response is more about trying to evade, you know, responsibility. You saw that in the response to the audit, rather than saying, hey, all right, we have a lapse here. We have a problem here. No one wants to see sex offenders getting Viagra. That's not the purpose of the Medicaid program.
Let's talk about rent control. Rent control is really hot now. We saw a huge group of people show up in Albany banging on the governor's glass doors. And, you know, it takes a lot for people to understand that there is a state government up here. We've always known that. But all of a sudden, you get something like rent control, and that's people's pocketbooks, and they show up. What do you say, Mr. Controller?
Well, Alan, you know, we're putting out a report this week that shows that a million New Yorkers pay more than 50% or more of their income towards housing.
That's unbelievable.
So this issue of housing affordability is an issue. It is a statewide issue. It's not just a New York City issue or a suburban issue, rural issue. All across the state, we have communities with this problem. Now, as you know, rent stabilization, rent control, whatever you want to call it, has always been a political hot potato. I remember from my years in the legislature, you know, the battle was always between the Assembly Democrats that tended to be more pro-tenant versus the Senate Republicans that were more protective of the real estate interests. Well, that's all been changed because of the political dynamic being different now with the state Senate. So you obviously have many that have advocated for reforms more favorable to tenants, saying, hey, you know, we're expecting something very different than what we've had before. And obviously that's the debate that's going on right now.
So what's your position? Yeah.
Well, you know, again, as controller, I don't have a vote in this. I can tell you when I was in the legislature, I represented, my district. I had a number of buildings that were multi-unit rental buildings. We had a number of tenants at one time that were covered by rent stabilization because Nassau County is one of the counties that actually has this. You saw the big change partially because many buildings were converted to co-ops and also because of some of the changes that happened over the years in weakening some of those protections. I've always felt that we needed to do more to protect tenants. I'm not weighing in on the particular bills. That's not my job at the moment, but I do think you're going to see a package of bills that will implement many of the reforms that the tenant advocates have been pushing for. What the exact bills will be, obviously that's the subject of the intense negotiations going on right now. But we have to recognize that housing affordability, big issue, especially for middle and lower income New Yorkers. We don't want to lose the diversity of our population. It is not just an urban or New York City issue. It's an issue that's affecting many of our communities across the state. And it also gets to the other piece that we have to address, which is creating more affordable housing. I mean, that needs to be part of what we want to do as well. We have an allocation in our pension fund investments to promote affordable housing. We do a lot through the Community Preservation Corps particularly, but I think that's obviously one of those big issues that we have to deal with. And hey, New York, by and large, is a desirable state for people to live in. Yep. No surprise, the housing costs go up, particularly in those neighborhoods that have become very attractive. Many people have been there for a long time, are feeling squeezed out. So it's not an easy issue, but I do think having adequate protections for certainly those on the rental side is something very important.
Okay, Tom DiNapoli, Mr. Controller, the stock market. How are we doing in the stock market? You're the sole trustee.
Yeah.
You have to approve what goes in and what comes out.
Yeah. Well, the gyrations continue, you know, depending on the tweet of the day or the tariff saber rattling of the day. And that's a concern. The markets took quite a dive in December, and that impacted, our final numbers for the pension fund return. We had a return of about 5.23%. We value the fund March 31st of every year. Our long-term goal is 7%, right? So I got to kick some of the headlines where, we fell way short of our goal. Well, we didn't fall way short. In the past 2 years, we were over 11%. Mm-hmm. I didn't see the headline saying we way exceeded our goal. It all balances out. So it depends on your view on pensions, which I protect. But, Alan, what I want to say is as far as being an investor, I want to make clear we do not have all of our pension fund money invested in the stock market. That's a big part of our portfolio.
You got real estate, other stuff. But I wanted to ask you.
But the reality is the markets are in a phase, and I think much of it has to do with what's happening in the U.S. with our own national administration and the global issues of Brexit and so on and China. The market's going to be up and down. We're going to continue to see swings. Nobody knows where it's going to end up.
The day that they had a period, when they discussed periods in English class, punctuation, were you absent?
I was in Madame Beerbaum's French class that day, actually.
Well, some things keep going on here. Let's talk about what you do, where you invest the money. So, for example, you released a plan as we speak on how to protect pension fund investment from climate change. And you're against legislation forcing divestment, as I understand it. Can you bring us up to date on all of that?
Yep. You know, we have a professional staff, smart people that understand investments. We work with advisors and investment partners. We have advisory committees. When we make judgments on where to put the pension fund money, it's really made with the best interest of the members of the plan, the 1.1 million New Yorkers and their families who are depending on us making smart choices as far as investment. It should not be a political judgment based on legislative fiat or legislative action. So the proposal to compel us from a list that a third-party source identifies as which companies we shouldn't go in, that's not an investment strategy. That's a political strategy. So the legislature, all due respect, Alan, I was there for 20 years, and I understand the role of the legislature, and I respect it. Their job is not to manage the pension fund. That's my job, and we do it well. And I really worry that interference could create the dynamic we see in other states where political decisions undercut the value of the fund.
Are they threatening to interfere, if I'm hearing you correctly?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. No, there are bills pending, as you point out, on the climate issue. And on the climate issue, look, I chair the Environment Committee. Environmental issues are very important. We have been a leader in incorporating considerations of climate risk into our investment decisions for years. We set up a decarbonization advisory panel, as we called it, along with the governor, of smart people who looked at this issue. They came up in April with some very strong recommendations on how we could better position the fund for the future. They specifically said not to divest as a strategy in and of itself, but rather to establish minimum standards, increase our allocation to climate solution investments. So what we are announcing, as you know, you and I are speaking, is our follow-up to those panel recommendations. So we have a climate action plan that I think really continues our leadership role. We're going to be very clear about developing those minimum standards, hiring staff to better position us to seek out investments that are climate solutions. We're going to look carefully at the companies we invest in. And frankly, if they're not meeting those standards, we'll consider changes our investment strategy, maybe even divesting from certain companies if it makes sense from a fiduciary perspective. And we're going to double the amount of money we're committing to our, what we've called the Sustainable Investment Program. We're also going to call it the Climate Solution Program now. So I think this strategy with the Climate Action Plan, implementing the goals of that those panel recommendations, puts us as a leader saying the Paris Agreement is real. Climate change is happening. It's urgent that we take action. We just need to take action that's consistent with our obligation to the members of the pension system, to the taxpayers who help fund it. And I think our strategy is the smart one and the right one on the climate issue and also on protecting the assets of the pension fund.
And yet, Tom DiNapoli, let's face it, your first obligation is to the people in the pension fund,
yep,
but they got to breathe the air too.
Yep. Absolutely.
So, but
that's why what we're doing is dealing with the climate issue and dealing with it in a responsible way that protects the retirement security. Alan, the debate too often becomes divest or not divest. So then you debate on that question instead of the issue of how do we deal with climate change and how do we improve it. Does anybody really think that if tomorrow we sell this stock that that's going to make the air cleaner? No. It sends a message, perhaps, but I think we need to do more than just send a message. I think we need to move companies, and particularly many of the European energy companies are moving to wind, to solar, to renewables. We also want to use our voice as an investor, as a shareholder, to get corporations, even the America ones, who perhaps now with Trump in the White House are feeling they got a little more wiggle room on this issue, we still want to hold them accountable. So it's investment, it's making smart choices, it's pressing companies to do the right thing. Yes, that will help our pensioners and all New Yorkers to have a cleaner and healthier environment.
So Tom DiNapoli, let's talk a little bit about congestive pricing in New York. There's a plan. You come into New York, you drive your car in, you're going to pay a toll maybe on the bridge, and maybe you'll have to pay also for just, not maybe, you will pay for being in the middle of Manhattan. You've been watching all of this from a fiduciary perspective. What do you make of it?
Well, the MTA certainly needs more resources, and that obviously was the jumping off point for
this. So this will give money to the Massachusetts... This will give money to the Metropolitan Transit Authority.
Yeah, we see where your loyalties are. Well, look, here's the problem, though, Alan. There's still a lot of question marks here. So the details still have to be spelled out. So I think, you know, until there's more certainty about how exactly it's going to be implemented and what exactly the costs are going to be, you know, there's still a lot of unknowns. So I wasn't surprised that it was adopted, because there are limited options in terms of revenue sources that there could be a consensus on. But I think the jury is still out until we see more of the details about how the plan is going to be implemented, which is not, you know, it's going to be coming in, you know, down the road. So it's not happening today. It'll be happening in the near future.
Do you get a seat at the table?
No. So, but you know, we monitor MTA funding. We certainly will certainly monitor revenues that are coming in. We don't have a seat at the table in terms of setting the ground rules.
Okay, so let me ask you about the school budget. School budgets did very well around New York State, I think, last time.
Yeah.
Is the school budget system fair to the students of New York?
Fair is an interesting word.
Yes, it is.
Because fair is very much in the eyes of the beholder. I remember, I may have mentioned this on the show at some point in the past, when I ran for assembly the first time, and remember, I was a former school board trustee, I said I was going to get a fair share for our schools in Nassau County. And people agreed with that. And then I arrived in Albany, sat there in the Democratic Conference, sat there on the floor of the assembly, and I found out everybody else ran on the same platform. They're going to get a fair share for their schools because, you know, fair is how you define it. If you live in a high-cost area and you don't get a lot of state aid, then you think it's unfair. If you live in an area where you have low property wealth and you don't have much of a tax base, then you're not getting enough state aid to provide a quality basic education, the system isn't fair. So I think, you know, we always have to struggle with that definition. From my personal point of view, we need to do a couple things. We rely too much on the property tax for many of our school districts. Outside of New York City has an income tax, but most communities do not in terms of funding schools. We need to have less reliance on the property tax, and we still have a situation where there are too many districts and too many students that are at risk that don't get adequate resources. So they've made improvements. You know, boosting the money as far as foundation aid has been an evolutionary process. That's one that I don't think is complete. You've got the tax cap, which creates other challenges for school boards in putting their budgets forward when the budgets have to be voted on. But I do think in most communities, you're seeing the public is viewing the additional money coming from Albany has been helpful. The school boards have been working very hard to comply with the tax cap, and that's why you've seen the very high percentage of budgets passing. That issue, though, of equity in education is one that is not resolved yet in our state.
Okay, so then I just want to go somewhere where you may not like to go, I don't know, and that is the elite high schools in New York, Stuyvesant, Science, Brooklyn Tech, you know, all of those, have been criticized severely for not enough Black, Hispanic students in them. And there's been a major push to change the exam which lets you in. I can only tell you I didn't go to one of those schools, so I just want to ask you what you make of all of that.
You know, it's not an issue that we have studied in any detail. Obviously, that's somewhat beyond our pay grade in the controller's office. But I do think you look at some of the analysis in some of those schools, you've seen a decrease in the diversity,
right,
going back decades. So it's not like this is a longstanding situation. In fact, it seems to have evolved in a way that perhaps caught some people by surprise when you actually look at the numbers. You know, how you get to that issue of greater diversity, ensuring there's appropriate opportunity and not diminishing, you know, the standards. I mean, that's a complex issue, and I think that's what both in New York City they're grappling with Department of Education and the mayor's office, and obviously there's legislative proposals to try to deal with that issue. I don't presume to be expert enough on it to have the magic solution that's going to make everybody happy, but obviously this is an issue that I would hope communities could come together on to come up with a solution that everybody feels comfortable with. I hope it is not one that will create racial or ethnic divisions in a way that we can't afford to have happen in New York.
Tom DiNapoli, I wanted to ask you a question. You You have a fairly robust staff. You know, you don't have everything you want, but you have to make some crucial decisions about who you're going to hire to work for you. And I know some of the people who do work for you, and I have great admiration for so many of them. But recently, you hired a guy named Elliot Auerbach, the former Ulster County Comptroller, who's now in his new job under you. He's now the Deputy Comptroller for the Division of Local Government and School Accountability. How crucial a hire was that?
I think it was it's a very key position in our office. It's a leadership position. Gabe Dayo had it for a number of years. He did a great job. He retired. And in looking to fill the position, I really wanted someone who, because that division oversees the audits, very important in terms of accountability with local municipal governments, school districts, but also the research and training component that we provide support for local governments. I wanted someone who not only would understand how to manage a team and a staff of auditors and professionals, but also someone who understands the challenges that our local officials, school district and municipal, are facing, so that we can achieve that goal of providing the oversight we're expected to provide, but also be an effective partner in terms of helping local governments through challenging times, challenging budgetary times. Elliot is someone I've gotten to know over the years. He's done a great job as the county controller for Ulster, and I think he is someone who really has a pulse on what's happening in the local communities. I wasn't sure he would be interested in the position. You know, I went to him. He wasn't coming to us. And he took a while to think about it. It didn't happen overnight. We said, yeah, I'm coming. Because, like, hey, he's been elected official. You got to give that independence up to go work for someone. But he sees it as a wonderful opportunity to do what he's been doing on a broader scale, on a statewide basis. He's going to do a great job.
And Tom DiNapoli, you're doing a great job, too. I am such an admirer of your ability to keep your feet on the ground and not to get riled by people like me who try to get you into fights with the governor and other people. And
it's not easy sometimes with you, no, Alan, but I appreciate you, and I appreciate you're always giving me the opportunity for your listeners to hear more about what we're doing in the Comptroller's office.
That's right. So anyway, we've been talking to New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli, trying to figure out exactly how we watch the pennies in New York State and where they go. And thanks for being with us again
on
the Capital Connection.